It was a full minute before Mother said anything. And then her voice was as quiet as Father's.
Charles, the time has come when this boy must have a father's firm hand. I am appalled by the degeneracy he has shown since we left East Rochester.
I had never heard Mother's voice quite like that, and I had never heard her call Father Charles. I thought my heart would pound itself to pieces while she was telling him what I had done. Hard as Father could spank, he never hurt me so much with a stick as he did when Mother stopped talking. He cleared his throat, and then he didn't make a sound for at least 2 full minutes. When he spoke, his voice was deep and dry, and I know he must have been coughing a lot on the way home.
Son, there's no question but what the thing you have done today deserves severe punishment. You might have killed yourself or the horse, but much worse than that, you have injured your own character. A man's character is like his house. If he tears boards off his house and burns them to keep himself warm and comfortable, his house soon becomes a ruin. If he tells lies to be able to do the things he should not do but wants to, his character will soon become a ruin. A man with a ruined character is a shame on the face of the earth.
He waited until his words had plenty of time to soak in, and then he said,
I might have given you a hard thrashing. If I did, you would possibly remember the thrashing longer than you would remember the injury you have done to yourself. I'm not going to do it. There were 18 cross ties in the gulch yesterday, and the section foreman told me they were going to replace 20 more. Until you have dragged every one of those ties home, you will wear your Buster Brown suit to school, and I will not take you anywhere with me.
It was 1/2 mile from the house to the gulch. Father showed me how to hook onto the ties with a chain and how to pull them up through the head of the gulch. By getting up early, I dragged one tie home each morning and 2 after school. With 6 on Saturdays, I had the job done in 2 weeks. It was a tough 2 weeks. I was sure I would become Molly again for wearing the Buster Brown suit to school. I think Grace saved that by telling everybody what a bad boy I was. Then, too, the weather turned windy and cold. The gulch half filled with dry tumbleweeds that scratched me when I was digging through them to get the ties. But worst of all, Mother got a song in her head. When that happened, she would sing the same tune over and over and over for 1 week at a time. That time it was, The Bird with a Broken Pinion. I don't think she was singing it just for me, but I could not go into the house without hearing about A Young Life Broken by Sin's Seductive Art, or that The soul that sin hath stricken never soars so high again. It made me think a lot, as I walked along behind Nancy and dragging a cross tie, about the permanent damage I had already done to my character. Chapter 5, The Big Wind. I think it was my lying about the ties that got us the buckboard. One night I came in from tie hauling to hear Father and Mother talking together in the kitchen. Mother was saying,
But Charlie, we can't just load the children into that old farm wagon like Cordwood and haul them off to church. We saved quite a little from what we expected to pay for the new horse and harness. Somewhere we should be able to find something better in the way of a conveyance that's within our means.
Mr. Cash came by on Saturday, and he had our buckboard tied behind his wagon. Sunday, we all went to church at Fort Logan. Church and Sunday school were held in the day school room. There were not enough seats to have them both at one time, so the grown folks stayed outside and talked while we had Sunday school, and we played outside while they had church. The fathers of most of the other children who went to Sunday school were soldiers at the fort. Some of the kids were kind of tough. I learned a couple of new words from them, and Philip learned a lot. He called Muriel a couple of them after we got home, and Mother cried so hard that Father sent all of us into the bedroom. We could only hear a word or two she was saying between sobs. It was something about not being able to stand what the ranch was doing to her boys. From then on, Mother held Sunday services at home. Father had been hauling long poles to be cut into fence posts for about a week when the big wind came. It was blowing when we woke up, and tumbleweeds were rolling across the prairie like big brown bowling balls pitched by some giant in the mountains. By school time, it was too strong for Grace and I to stand against. By noon, it had racked our house until some of the windows had broken out and the doors were jammed fast in the casings. The whole house was vibrating like a beaten drum, and every few minutes a joint among the rafters would crack with a report as sharp as a rifle shot. Father's face was gray, Mother's was milk white. Neither of them spoke, their mouths were clamped tight, and the muscles were popping out and in on the sides of Father's jaws. I could see Muriel, Philip, and Hal crying, but against the roar of the wind, I couldn't hear them. Father went out and untied the horses. They drifted away to the east, the wind whipping their tails up under their bellies. Next, he brought poles and propped them against the lee side of the house. Mother huddled us into a corner of the bedroom, away from the windows. She crouched over us like a hen brooding her chicks. There came a tearing screech from the roof as the wind ripped away a section of the shingles and sheets of plaster fell from the ceiling. Father crawled in through the blown-out window with a coil of rope in his hand. He took his Sunday suit from the corner and told Mother to put it on. Then he knotted the rope around our chests and shoulders until all but Hal were strung on it, the way Mother used to string popcorn balls for Christmas. We were all about 5 feet apart. Philip was on one end and Muriel on the other. Mother had taken off her dress and put on Father's suit with the sleeves and legs rolled way up. Father tied Philip's end of the rope around her waist and Muriel's end around his own. Then he motioned Mother to follow, tied Hal on his back like a papoose, and crawled out of the window. As she passed us out to him, he had us fall to the ground and lay still. After he lifted Mother down, he crouched and told us to crawl on our stomachs like horned toads, that dust would get in our eyes, but we must keep them open so as not to crawl into cactus beds. Our nearest neighbors were the Altlands, a mile upwind. Fort Logan was to the east, 3.5 miles away, with no houses between. Father crawled east, and we crawled after him. When we had wriggled along for 100 yards or so, Father stopped to let us rest. I looked back toward Philip and Mother. Philip must have gotten cactus spines in his hand because he held it out toward Mother and tried to sit up. The wind caught him and rolled him like a tumbleweed as far as the rope would let him go. As he went, Mother sprang to her hands and knees. She was no more than up before she sprawled forward on her face as though some giant had put his foot on her from behind and shoved. In that same backward glance, I saw the roof of our new barn fly away like a sheet of newspaper. We started on. The next time we stopped to rest, I looked back again. There was blood on Mother's face, and our barn was gone completely. A few minutes after we had begun crawling again, something like the shadow of a great bird flashed past me on the ground. I raised my head, and a second later the body of our farm wagon struck a few feet beyond Father. It bounced crazily like a football and flew away in kindling wood. My eyes were running from the dirt in them, my nose burned as though the dust in it were pepper, and I was coughing from breathing through my mouth. At the next rest, I lifted my head again and looked up and down the line. Father was coughing hard. I could see Hal bounce up and down on his back. Philip was sobbing and gasping for breath against the pull of the wind, and Mother's face was black where dirt had mixed with the blood. I had no idea where Father was taking us, but after a dozen or more stops, I knew we were going more north than east. We were not going to Fort Logan. We crawled across the wagon road and on and on. The wind ripped up curled, dry leaves of buffalo grass and raked them across our faces like jigsaw blades. At last, Father stopped and waved his lifted arm. Then he raised them both and made motions like a man pulling himself up a rope. We all understood and drew ourselves up to him. There was fresh blood at the corners of his mouth. We got our heads close to his, and he yelled, "We're almost there. We're going to be all right." It seemed hours longer before we crawled into the head of a gulch leading down to Bear Creek. Under the level of the prairie, we could crawl on our hands and knees. Father led us along to where there was an overhang in the west bank of the gulch. There was hardly any wind there. I was so tired I could barely move. I was shaking all over. I wasn't frightened any longer, and nothing was hurting me. But I started to cry. I did not know what I was crying for, but I could not make myself stop. Everybody but Father and Mother was crying. The wind went down with the sun. At twilight, it was no more than a breeze. We crawled from under our shelter under the bank, cold and stiff and ragged. Our faces were smeared with blood, cut by the sharp grass that had been whipped against us by the wind. Our hands, arms, and legs were burning with cactus spines. It seemed to me that we had crawled miles on our stomachs. But when we came out at the head of the gulch, our house stood little more than half a mile away. It and the bunkhouse stood alone. Barn, privy, wagon, and buckboard were gone. The house leaned tiredly against the prop poles. From the wagon road it looked like a deserted ruin, and when we got to the back door, Father stood Hal down and put his shoulder against the door. It stuck tight, and he heaved against it, but not as he had heaved when he lifted Nig's hind legs from the trestle. He looked tired and old. The inside of the house looked almost as deserted as the outside. Fallen plaster, broken glass, and dirt covered everything. Father coughed hard after pushing the door open and wiped his mouth with a red-stained handkerchief. Sometimes Mother cried over little things, but she did not cry then. She hadn't all day. She bustled right through the kitchen and into the bedroom, with her underlip bitten in between her teeth. In a few seconds, I heard her shaking bedclothes so hard that they snapped. While she was doing it, Father looked over the chimney to see if it was cracked, then started a fire in the stove. Next, he took boards from the bunkhouse and nailed them over the broken kitchen window. We youngsters did not know where to begin in helping to get cleaned up and stood huddled by the stove. When Father had finished with the window, he put his hat on and started out the door. Mother came from the bedroom while he was in the doorway and said,
"Charlie, where are you going?"
She had spoken quietly, but her voice was husky, coming from way down in her throat. Father said,
"I've got to find the horses, Mame. Heaven only knows where they may be by now. They may have fallen in a gulch."
Mother went over and took hold of his arm. She stood close against him and looked up into his face. Her voice was still husky as she said,
"Ralph can stay home from school tomorrow and find them. You're going to bed."
Father bent over and kissed her on the forehead as he tried to take her hand off of his arm, but she would not let go.
"Charlie,"
she said. It was little more than a whisper.
"We came here to save your life. Are you going to throw it away over so little? We need you. Oh, we need you, Charlie."
From where we were standing, I saw her eyes fill up with tears, but none spilled over. As I watched her, I heard the fast beat of running horses' feet. Fred and Bessie Altland came into the yard, circled and pulled up at the steps. Fred jumped off the buckboard with the reins still in his hand and cried,
"Charlie! For God's sake, what's happened to you, man? You look like a ghost."
After Mother told them about the horses nearly blowing over and about our crawling to the gulch, Bessie said they had worried all day because they knew we did not have a storm cellar. They made us all go home with them and stay for 3 days, while Fred and Bessie helped Mother get our house fixed up again. Mrs. Altland and Mother would not let Father get out of bed for the whole 3 days. Chapter 6. We Become Real Ranchers. It rained most of the next couple of weeks. One of Fred's hired men had found our horses and what was left of the wagon and buckboard. Nig was all right, but Bill stood with his back humped up most of the time, and all the starch seemed to have drained out of Nancy's legs. We kept them in the end of the bunkhouse Father had cut off to use for a kitchen, while he and I worked on the other end. There was no school when it rained, so I could stay home and help a lot. We built a new wagon body and put new spokes in the wheels of the buckboard, right there in the bunkhouse. Between showers, we built a new privy. We were never able to find even one board of our old one. I had to bring 2 pails of milk from the Altlands every night. When I had eggs to bring, too, Grace went with me to lug the basket. Mother was making Father drink all of 1 bucket of milk every day, and giving him raw eggs with a spoonful of brandy in the glass. I still liked the smell of that brandy, but the weather was getting warm enough so that I could not get blue any more. Father's cough got better day by day, but as he grew stronger, Nancy grew weaker. One morning, near the end of the 2nd week, Father went out to the bunkhouse and found her dead. Grace and I had to go to school that day, so we missed the funeral. Our big wind must have been an ill one, because I never heard of anyone it did any good, except maybe it did help us a little in one way. The Saturday after Nancy died, Father and I were putting the buckboard back together when a man with a big load of new boards stopped out in front of our house. He came in and said his name was Wright, and that he lived a couple of miles up the creek. He said the wind had raised the dickens with his buildings, and he had noticed how nicely we were getting fixed up again. After he had watched Father work for a little while, he said, "You seem to be pretty handy sort of fellow with a hammer and saw. I wish I could get you to come and help me get fixed up. I'd give you $3 a day for your time, or trade work with you, or trade something I might have that you wanted." Father told Mr. Wright he ought to be getting started with his own plowing now that the rains had come, but he would talk it over with Mother and let him know the next day. Mother must have said it was all right because Father helped Mr. Wright for a couple of weeks. Father drove Bill and Nig up to Mr. Wright's the first morning. When he came home, he had a saddled bay mare tied to the tailgate of the wagon and a little black-and-white collie puppy in the pocket of his reefer coat. He said Mr. Wright had insisted on lending him the mare to ride back and forth, but the puppy was ours to keep. It was still so young, it was wobbly on its legs and cute as could be. We all wanted to claim it, but Father would not let us. He said Muriel could name it, but it would belong to all of us. She named it King. I liked King a lot, but it was the saddle horse that really took my eye. She was a crabby Morgan mare, and laid her ears back every time anyone went near to her. In the mornings, when Father put the saddle on, she would fling her head around and snap at him with her teeth, but she always missed him by an inch or two. She could run like a greyhound, and I wanted to ride on her so much that I couldn't think about anything else, but neither Father nor Mother would let me go within a rod of her. I had got so I could ride Willie Aldevoat's donkey without my feet being tied together, and only holding on to the belly strap with one hand. Willie had taught me how to squeeze my knees tight behind the withers and ride on them instead of the seat of my pants. I had spent hours practicing, and I knew that, especially with a saddle, I could ride that mare as easy as pie. It was about the middle of April when Father finished helping Mr. Wright repair his buildings. He took Bill and Nig with him that last Friday. I remember so well because that was the day we changed from being immigrants to being ranchers. When he came home that night, the bay mare was tied to the tailgate. She didn't have the saddle on, but there was a driving harness in the wagon, along with 4 little Berkshire pigs and 2 gunny sacks with the heads of 6 hens sticking out of holes in them. I wanted to claim and name the new mare, but Father would not let me. He said we had all except Philip named something, so he must have his choice. He chose Fanny. Mother didn't want the end of the bunkhouse as a kitchen after the horses had been living in it, so Saturday morning we hooked Bill and Nig to it and hauled it out where the first barn had stood. It had been built with board walls inside and out, and the space between them stuffed with straw. We worked to beat the band all day. After we got it moved, Father ripped up the floor and pulled off all the inside boards. He let Grace and me pull the old nails and pound them out straight, while Muriel and Philip were lugging the straw to the hen coop and the pig pen that he had built with the floorboards. When Father hauled the piece for the barn away, it left the bunkhouse with one open end. That Sunday he built a new end onto it with boards he had pulled off the inside of the barn and made a partition down the middle, so there was a room for Philip and me and one for Grace and Muriel. While he was doing it, Grace and I helped Mother move the beds and make us bureaus out of boxes the groceries had come in. She put cloth around them with ruffles, and we made scalloped paper covers for them and cut doilies from pieces of old wallpaper. By supper time, everything was done, and Grace and I were so excited about sleeping in a real bunkhouse that we could hardly get away from the table quickly enough. Father had promised Mother that he would plow her a garden out behind the barn before he did anything else. He started it early Monday morning, but he had not got around the plot once before we had to go to school. He had made a triple tree for the plow and balanced it carefully, so to adjust the amount of pull to the strength of each horse. Nig was to walk in the furrow and pull the biggest share, Bill in the middle with the next biggest, and Fanny on the outside with only a little more than half as much load as Nig. But Fanny had no intention of being a plow horse. Oh, she was all right while Father was putting Nancy's collar and the hames with the chain traces on her, but when he tried to rein her up beside the other horses, she squealed and tried to bite chunks out of Bill's neck. Father fixed that quick enough by fastening a stick about 3 feet long between her bridle and Bill's collar, but when he hooked her traces, she kicked and jumped around till she had both hind legs over them and was faced the wrong way. Father unhooked her and talked easy till he had her back where she belonged, but every time he got the traces hooked to the triple tree, she'd do the same thing all over again. If it had been Mother, I think she would have killed Fanny right then and there, but Father didn't seem to get mad at all. Only the muscles on his jaws went out and in a little. At last he made another jockey stick and put her in the middle with one stick fastened to Bill's collar and the other to Nig's. That way she could not swing out around, but she did kick like fury and got both legs over the traces. Bill and Nig didn't get any more excited than Father did while Fanny slatted and threw herself around. She acted just like a little kid in a tantrum. When she had quieted down a little, Father put the reins over his shoulder, stuck the point of the plow in the ground, and clucked to the team. Bill and Nig started up when Father clucked, but Fanny stood rock still. The triple tree caught her on the heels, and then the real fun started. Fanny went away from there like a stone out of a slingshot. When she reached the end of the jockey sticks, she went straight up and came down bucking with heels flying in all directions. Finally, she got one foreleg inside Bill's bridle rein and one hind leg inside Nig's breeching. Then she went down with Nig on top of her. When Father got them untangled, he made me go to school. I never heard Father swear, but I always wondered if he didn't that time as soon as I was out of earshot. I stopped by Altland's for the milk on my way home from school. Fred was out by the corral fixing a disc harrow, and I went over to tell him how Fanny had acted when Father hooked her up to the plow. He laughed as though it were a big joke.
"It's no wonder old man Wright traded her off cheap," he said. "He spent 10 years and a dozen sets of harness trying to break her to drive double. I'll sure take my hat off to your old man if he can plow half an acre with her. Why the hell wouldn't the stubborn down east Yankee let me lend him a good horse to plow with? Say, how much land is he figuring to turn over this year anyway?"
When I told him Father was going to plow the whole place if Bill held out, he squinted up one eye for a minute and said,
"Go on in and get your milk. I'll give you a lift home."
Father had most of the garden plowed when we got there. The big horses were walking slowly, just one step after another. Fanny was soaking wet and tossing her head up and down, but she was plowing, so I told Fred he'd have to take his hat off to Father. Father put his foot up on the hub of Fred's buckboard the way he always did. They talked about what would be best to plant on new sod ground. They talked and talked. Then Fred said,
"Charlie, how much of this place do you figure on putting into crops?"
Father looked over toward the horses and said,
"I'd like to put it all in, Fred. But with the late start I've got and the rate I've been going today, I guess I'll be lucky if I get in 80 acres.
Fred just sat chewing for a minute or two. Then he squirted a line of tobacco juice between the nigh horse's heels.
"You know this prairie land won't produce much in the way of grain crop the first year. Drinks up a hell of a lot of water. A fellow ought to put in crops like peas and beans and alfalfa the first year, so as to get air back into the land. Why don't you put in about 10 acres of alfalfa? We've had quite a bit of rain this spring, and if you sow it with the oats, get it in before the 1st of May, it might get roots down to moisture before it burns out on you. Then you could put in another 10 to peas and beans, and you'd have about all you wanted to take care of this first year."
Father stood looking down at his foot on the hub of the buckboard for all of 2 minutes. Then he looked up at Fred, and his voice was real quiet when he said,
"What are you telling me, Fred? Haven't I got any water?"
Fred didn't answer until he'd spit between the off-horse's feet and cut another corner of his plug.
"Yep, Charlie, you've got water. 10 inches. This land will produce 40 bushels of wheat to the acre if you've got an inch of water to the acre. Without an inch to the acre, you're lucky if you get any."
Father pushed his hat back and scratched his head a little.
"Can I count on getting the full 10 inches, Fred?" he asked.
"Well, that's the hell of it," said Fred. "You're a tail ender on the ditch. When the creek's high and the ditch is running full at the dam, you'll get your share. But when it's running low and the crops are burning up, you'll be able to lug all you get in a bucket. I won't steal water from you, Charlie. But when only half my own is coming through to me and my crop's suffering, I won't pass it on to you."
Neither of them said anything for a long time. Then Fred said,
"Your cousin ought to have found out about it before he got you out here. Why, man, you couldn't run 10 inches of water to this garden from where the ditch comes onto your place. The ground would drink it all up on the way. I'll tell you what I'll do. I've got 200 inches with my place. I'll use all the water that comes as far as me for 20 days, then give you the whole head for one. That will give you about 20 acres of good soaking, often enough to make a crop this first year. After that, you might handle as much as 25.
Chapter 7. I Become a Horseman. Father and Mother must have sat up and talked nearly all of that night. I woke just as the moon was slipping down behind the mountains, and there was still a light burning in the kitchen. Mother had brought some garden seed from New England and had bought more at Fort Logan. The next day she let me stay home from school and help her plant peas and potatoes and carrots and beets. We dug trenches most of the forenoon. Then Mother sent me to shovel the horse manure from behind the barn onto the wagon so Father could haul it out for us at noon when he came in from plowing. Mother had me put manure in the bottom of the trenches and cover it over with an inch or two of dirt. Then she laid in the cut pieces of potato and hoed dirt over them. We were right in the middle of it when I looked up and saw half a dozen cowboys riding by on the wagon road. I waved, and one of them turned his horse and came cantering across the prairie to where we were. I knew him as soon as he got near enough for me to see his face. He was the same cowboy who had given me the ride. He flipped out of the saddle while his horse was sliding to a stop and took his hat off to Mother with a sort of half bow.
"I see you folks are really getting dug in. We was scared the big wind might have blowed you clean out of the country."
While he was talking to Mother, I was looking at his horse. It was a blue roan, first one I had ever seen.
"Yes, we're here to stay. My husband is going to build a storm cellar, so there won't be any danger of our being blown clean away."
I wished Mother hadn't said clean away. It sounded the way she did when she didn't like somebody, and I wanted her to like my cowboy friend. I walked around the roan and looked at him from the other side while Mother and my cowboy kept talking. Mother didn't talk much, but the cowboy said, "Lady, you're sure wasting your time bearing these here barn cleanings under your spuds. You're due to get tops enough without it. All you got to have for this ground is water, and God help the man that ain't got it." The hair on the blue horse was shinier than it was on Cousin Phil's prince. It rippled like oily water when he moved the muscles under it. To me, it was like a magnet. I had to touch it with my hand, so I stepped up close to his shoulder. Just as I was reaching my hand up, the cowboy called, "Hey, partner, watch out. You're on the offside. Come on around here." While I was coming around, he said to Mother, "This old cayuse is as clever as a kitten if you stay on the nigh side, but he might kick the stuffin' out of him over on the offside." He had ground-tied the roan by just dropping the reins when he got off. He picked them up while he was talking and passed them around the horse's neck. Then he caught me by one arm and swung me into the saddle. "How about a little ride, Puncher?" Mother thought he was just going to lead the horse around a little with me on it, and she didn't say anything except,
"Be careful,"
when he was showing me how to stick my feet into the loops of the strap that held the stirrups. As soon as I got them in, he passed me the lines and clucked. The roan went off in a smooth, easy canter, and Mother cried,
"No, no, he'll fall."
My friend laughed, and I could hear him say, "Oh, shucks, if he falls, the ground'll catch him." It didn't. At first I held on to the saddle horn with one hand. The ground seemed so much farther away than it did when I was riding the donkey. But I didn't feel a bit as though I were going to fall off, so I let go and waved back to Mother and my cowboy. The only time I was frightened at all was when I went to turn him around to go back. We had gone clear out by the railroad, and I was afraid he might fall down going across, so I pulled on the left rein, but he swung around to the right. For just a second, I thought I was going to take a header, but I kicked out hard with my left foot and was back in balance again. I could see Mother was peeved when we came cantering in. Her mouth was pinched up that way. For just a second, I thought about seeing if I could flip off as my friend had done when he came up, but the ground was a long way down and I was scared to try it. Anyway, my feet were stuck in the loops. He reached up and took me off while Mother stood with her hands on her hips. She looked at me with that look of hers that said, "Come here, young man," and I went. She didn't say a word to me, but her eyes blazed at the cowboy as if she would like to skin him.
"You might have killed him. If he'd have fallen off, that horse would have trampled him to death."
He just laughed. "No, ma'am, that old pony wouldn't kill nobody. If he'd have fallen off, Old Blue would have just stood there and waited for him to pick himself up. Now you watch." And then he said to me, "Didn't have no trouble with him, did you, Little Britches?"
I said, "No, only he don't steer very good. I pulled the rein to make him go one way, and he went the other."
He laughed again. "Well, he's just rein-wise, and you ain't, that's all. Now you watch." Then he turned around toward Mother, took his big hat off, and said, "You watch too, ma'am. You'll see how safe he is." He kicked up one leg and flew right into the saddle without ever touching the stirrup. He whistled between his teeth as he went up, and Blue was gone with his feet kicking chunks of sod out behind him. The roan had hardly gone 50 feet before he sat right down on his hind legs and skidded. Then the cowboy made him do more tricks than an organ grinder's monkey. They turned around and around in a circle and from one side to the other so that it looked like dancing. Then he would run a little way full tilt and be turned around before he got through sliding. I noticed that the cowboy never did pull on either rein. He just held them in his left hand up over the horse's neck, and whichever way he moved his hand, that was the way the roan went. Then he did one that made Mother and me both squeal. With the pony going lickety-larrup, the cowboy fell right out of the saddle. He lit on the back of his shoulders, turned a half-somersault, and came up on his feet. The horse stopped so fast they were standing there side by side, as if they were just waiting for the mailman to come along. The cowboy looked around at Mother and took off his hat. It had stayed on all the way through the somersault. He stepped back into the saddle again and trotted over to where we were. First he said to me, "You catch on, little britches?" Then he took off his hat to Mother again and said, "Hiram Beckman's the name. They call me Hi." As he raced back toward the road, he turned and waved his hat. Mother and I waved back. I could hardly wait for Father to come in from the field to tell him about Hi and his blue roan horse. Father had been plowing way over across the tracks, and I didn't think he'd noticed us, because he never stopped to look when I could see him. I ran out to meet him when he came and got all mixed up. I was trying to tell him about it so fast. He put his hand out and rumpled up my hair. I didn't know what he meant, but he said, "I guess you're a chip off the old chopping block. If you understand them, you never have any trouble making them understand you. You did all right on that horse. I knew you weren't afraid by the way he was acting." We walked along a little way. Then he rumpled my hair again and said, "Your father was proud of you, son." It was the first time he had ever told me that, and I got a lump in my throat. Then he told me that Hi might be a little bit of a show-off, but he was a good horseman, not so much because he could fall off and come up on his feet, but because he had been patient in training Blue. He said that Blue wasn't a bit afraid of Hi, or he would not have handled so smoothly, and that it was the best example he had ever seen of complete understanding between a man and a horse. "If you want to be a good horseman," he said, "the first thing you'll have to learn will be how a horse thinks, and the next, to think the same way yourself."
That Sunday was nice and warm. After the chores were done, Father said,
"Mame, this is too nice a day to be cooped up in the house. If Fanny hadn't been plowing all week, I'd say let's hitch her up to the buckboard and take a drive up to the mountains. But she hasn't steadied down yet and is making twice as much work of it as she needs to. So what do you say? Let's pack up a picnic lunch and a good book, and we'll make a day of it down by the creek."
We all went running around trying to help Mother get ready faster, when we'd have helped more by just keeping out from under her feet. By 10 o'clock, the big lunch basket we had on the train was packed, and we were on our way down over the hill to Bear Creek. Father found a place where the creek made a wide curve through a grove of cottonwood trees and tumbled down in a cascade to a deep, clear pool lined with willows. He showed us how to skip the flat stones on the bank across the pool, and then we all went wading in the creek, even Mother and Hal. Mother took a puckering string from her petticoat and a safety pin so Philip could go fishing in the pool, while Father taught me how to whittle a willow stick into a whistle. Grace and Muriel went up the creek to pick up colored stones while Mother unpacked the lunch basket and boiled water to make tea for herself and Father. Pretty soon, Grace came running back, calling for all of us to come quick. She had found a whole bushel of pure gold and had left Muriel to guard it till we got there. We all went running, but Father. He tried to act as if he were hardly interested, but he did walk faster than usual. All the way, Grace kept babbling about how we were rich now and could get a cow and a pony to drive to school. When we got to where Muriel was, the sand near the shore was all covered with shiny yellow flakes. Father took some of it on his hand and looked at it carefully. Then he said,
"Girlie, I wish you were right, but I believe it's mica. I think they call it fool's gold. I read about it once, but if I had not,
I'd certainly have been fooled, too. After we had our picnic, Mother read to us. She didn't read like other people. She talked a book. I mean, if you were where you could hear her but could not see her, you would be sure she was telling you the story from memory instead of reading it. And another thing different about Mother's reading was that she didn't care if you watched the book over her shoulder. I used to watch her eyes by the hour as she read. They would swoop across the page like a barn swallow across a hayfield. Then she would look up and recite for a full minute before she looked back at the book again. When Mother read, we children had to be quiet and pay attention. We could do most anything we pleased with our hands, like making whistles, stringing dried berries for beads, or playing with dolls. But if one of us whispered, Father would snap his fingers. If he ever got to the third snap, Mother would close the book and we would do something else for a while. I don't remember Mother ever reading anything that I could not understand, and I never heard any of the others say so either. But I don't think many people would have read us the same books that she did. That day it was John Halifax, Gentleman. Maybe she skipped spots we couldn't have understood, and maybe some of it drifted over our heads, but at least we remembered the stories that she read. I think part of the reason was that we could raise a hand whenever we wanted an explanation of any word or situation. I liked John Halifax a lot. But as the afternoon passed, I found my mind wandering from the tannery to the open range, where High might be punching cattle on his blue roan. The more I thought of High, the farther I left John Halifax behind. After Mother had explained to our Muriel Joy that Father took her name from that very book, I suggested that maybe I should leave early to get the milk before it was too late. I had my plans all made, if Father said yes. He said it. I started up over the hill in the direction of the Altlands, but as soon as I got over the shoulder of the first rise of ground, I headed for home as fast as I could scramble. I got the milk pail, a 10-pound lard bucket, and set it in the wagon. Next, I untied Fanny's halter rope and led her out there, too. I tied her to one of the wheels with less than a foot slack in the rope so she could not back away. Then I got her bridle, took one of the long reins from the driving harness, and fastened an end to each bit ring. By standing in the wagon box, I could reach her head all right, but I was afraid she would run away when I took her halter off, so first I tied the loose end of the rope good and tight around her neck. Fanny was one of those mares that fought the bit, but I didn't know that, nor what to do about it. I guess I just expected her to open her mouth wide and wait for me to lay the bit into it. When I showed her the bridle, she tossed her head and pulled back to the end of the rope. I leaned out of the wagon as far as I dared, holding the bit up toward her lips. When I got it close, she would bob her head up and down and swing around where I couldn't reach her. As Fanny kept dancing away from the bridle, I kept one eye peeled for sight of the folks coming back from the creek. Usually, we would beg Mother to say poetry for us after she had stopped reading. Sometimes we could keep her going for an hour or so, but I was usually the one who did most of that begging. If they had got Mother going on a good long one like Horatius at the bridge, I'd be all right. But if it was just a short one like The Day Is Done, I was sunk. The more Fanny jerked her head around, the madder I got at her, and the more afraid I was that I would get caught before I had a chance to try to ride her. I climbed out a straddle of the wheel and tried to push the bit in between her clenched teeth as her head bobbed. Finally, I remembered that Father talked quietly to her when he made her plow, and decided to try it. I got down and patted her on the shoulder. As soon as her ears were pointed forward, I untied the halter rope and pulled it up easily, till I had her chin right up to the wheel tire. Then I tied it tight and climbed back on the wagon. I kept telling her what a nice mare she was as I offered her the bit again. It made no impression. She still kept her teeth locked. My time was running out. Even if it was Horatius, I couldn't stand there forever. I stuck one thumb in between her lips and gouged down with my thumbnail. That seemed to be something Fanny understood. She opened her teeth and took the bit. I was so excited I forgot to buckle the cheek strap, but grabbed up my bucket and shinnied over onto her neck. When I had worked my way back to the Withers, I untied her neck rope and we were on our way. I was quite surprised to find that she was easier to ride than that kicking donkey, and her withers were slim enough so that I could get a good knee hold. Fanny did not canter smoothly like the blue roan, and I did not have any stirrup straps to balance myself with, but I was still on top when we got to the Altlands. I tied her way over at the end of the pole corral, hoping no one would see I had ridden her, and so that I would have the poles to climb up onto when I was ready to get on again. I hadn't fooled anybody at the Altlands. I guess they had seen me coming up the road. Fred said,
"I knew your pa was proud about you riding High's pony, but I'd bet your ma wouldn't let you try Wright's mare bareback."
I remembered what he had said before about betting his life I'd make a horseman, and I thought maybe if I acted like Mother knew already, they would not bring the matter up later, so I said,
"Oh, she saw me ride High's blue horse, and she knows I'm going to be a horseman. She doesn't care."
Bessie made me take the milk in their tin can instead of in our lard bucket, and it was lucky that she had. I tried to hold the can still on the way home, but Fanny seemed to be in a hurry to get there and ran like all get-out. The can got to bouncing up and down, and I was so busy holding on with my knees that I just had to let it bounce. The cover popped off, and milk went everywhere. As we came out of the last gulch, there was the whole family coming up over the hill from the creek. The nerves in my bottom started to tingle, and it was not from rubbing on Fanny's back. It was too late now to turn back. I knew Father would have seen Fanny because her feet were clattering on the adobe road like sticks on a snare drum. For just about a second, I thought he might not have seen that I was on her, and that I might be able to dive off like High, come up on my feet. The ground was going by so fast that I was actually afraid to look down, let alone dive off, but I did not want to admit it and told myself I'd better not try it because I'd spill the rest of the milk. I had planned to ride Fanny up to the wagon so I could get off without dropping the milk can, but she had her own ideas about where she was headed for and shot right into the barn. I could see I was going to be raked off if I didn't do something about it, and do it in a hurry. I dived head first at the manure pile, milk can and all. That's where Father found me when he came running around the corner of the barn a minute later. I wasn't hurt a bit, and I still had the empty milk can, but my best Buster Brown was kind of messed up. Mother and the rest of the youngsters were only seconds behind Father. Mother was furious after she got over being scared and demanded that Father give me a good hard spanking. She said he could talk to me till he was black in the face and it would not do a bit of good because my wickedness was so great that it had killed my conscience. Nothing but fear of bodily pain would save me from a life of crime. Father didn't say a word, but just turned me over his knee while I was trying to tell him that I hadn't lied to be able to do what I had wanted to do, so had not injured my character anymore. Father had a trick I never knew about before. He must have cupped his hand up some, because every whack sounded like it was killing me, but hardly stung at all. I howled loud enough to make up the difference. Chapter 8. I Become a Sort of Cowboy. By the beginning of May, school had pretty well petered out. Nobody sent boys to school when they were needed at home to help with the plowing or planting, so when it got down to where only four girls and I were left, school closed for the summer. The day after it closed, Mrs. Corcoran came to see Mother about getting me to work for them. They had about 30 milk cows and used to take cream to Fort Logan every day. In the summer, they pastured the cows on the quarter section south of us. Because there weren't any fences, somebody had to herd them to keep them from getting into Altlands and Carl Henry's grain fields. She said she would pay me 25 cents a day, and I would only have to work from 7 in the morning till 6 at night. I guess Mother thought they herded cows on foot in Colorado, as they did in New England, so she said I could do it. I didn't have any such ideas at all and was all excited about being a cowboy. My biggest worry was that I didn't have a 10-gallon felt hat instead of a straw one from the grocery store at Fort Logan. I spent the rest of the afternoon out behind the barn, twisting myself a pair of spurs out of pieces of baling wire. It seemed best to sort of take it for granted that I was going to ride Fanny, so I was up and dressed in time to help Father feed the horses before breakfast. I shoveled manure to the beat the band while he was bringing in the hay and said, "Which bridle had I better put on Fanny for herding the cows?" Father grinned at me and rumpled up my hair. I had combed it that morning with plenty of water and had made a hook in the front lock so it hung down over my forehead like Hi's did. He said, "Sorry, son, but I guess you'll have to take it on your feet today. Carl's going to let me use his drill to plant the alfalfa, and I'll have to use Fanny." I nearly hopped up and down. I tried to keep my face straight, but I was laughing all over inside. I was sure, from the way Father said it, that he was going to let me ride Fanny, now that he knew I could do it. It didn't make any difference if I had to wait a day or two. After breakfast, I got my spurs from where I had hidden them under the hay and poked them in front of my blouse. I thought I'd be at least part cowboy if I had spurs, even if I did have to walk. Mr. Corcoran was a milk cow man, not a horseman. He did not have any nice horses like Fred Altland's bays or Carl Henry's chestnuts. They were mostly horses about like our Bill and Nig. There was an old black plug in the corral with the cows. He had faded out to a brownish color. Mr. Corcoran brought out an old work harness bridle with blinders and put it on the horse. Then he boosted me on and gave me a switch.
"Old Ned ain't too spry, but you give him a cut with that switch and he'll get a move on. Now, don't let none of them cows get into Fred's or Carl's grain, or they'll skin you alive. And don't run none of them cows. Some's with calf, and they're all milkers."
I wasn't too happy with Ned, but at least he was a horse. I had driven the herd nearly as far as the wagon road when Mr. Corcoran bellowed after me,
"Be careful not to let 'em get into no green alfalfa. It would bloat 'em and kill 'em."
Everything went fine till I got past Altland's house. Fred's field from the house to the section corner was unfenced and half a mile long. It was in alfalfa, about 6 inches high. My cows spied it from 100 yards away, and some of them started running for it. I kicked Ned with my heels, but he wasn't at all nervous and didn't even hurry his walk. Then I clipped him a little with the switch, and he took a half a dozen trotting steps before he went back to walking. His feet were as big as footballs, and every time he trotted, I bounced a foot high and came down with a thud. He was a lot wider in the withers than Fanny, so I couldn't get a good knee clamp on him, and I wasn't a bit sure I wasn't going to bounce clear off of his back. Some of my cows had already reached the alfalfa, and I expected to see them start falling over in great bloated corpses. I swung my switch high and started cutting it down over Ned's rump, my spurs, which I had twisted onto my bare feet as soon as we reached the road, had crumpled at my first kick. At the second cut, Ned got the idea I wanted him to hurry and trotted a dozen or so steps. I was so busy staying on that I couldn't think to swat him again and lift him into a canter. Now all the cows were in the alfalfa, and I knew my career as a cowboy was blowing up right in my face. I didn't care about falling off any longer. They had to be gotten out of there some way. After a couple more hard licks, the switch broke in my hand. There was only one thing left to do, so I piled off Ned and took after the cows afoot, yelling at the top of my lungs. The only stick I could find was too heavy for me to handle with one hand, so I waded into the herd, swinging it like a baseball bat. Instead of driving them back onto the road, I only drove them farther into the alfalfa field. I was so busy swinging and yelling that I did not see Fred until his tall bay horse was almost on top of me. Fred had a long black snake whip and snaked those cows out of there in about a minute and a half. Ned was making the most of his chance. He had not moved a foot from where I slid off, and had his nose buried in the alfalfa halfway to his eyes. Fred told me to go get him while he kept the cows moving. I couldn't much more than reach Ned's belly. There was nothing to climb up on, and I had no idea how I'd get aboard him. Fred yelled,
"Hang over his neck and kick. He'll hist you up."
He did, and I went up with my club in my hand. Ned had a lot more respect for it than he did for the switch, and I caught up to Fred in a hurry. The things he said about Mr. Corcoran were good to listen to. They were just the things I would have said myself if I hadn't been afraid of the damage it might do to that character of mine. I wished Father had never told me about it. Fred helped me till we got the cows over onto the piece of prairie where I was supposed to pasture them. Then he gave me his black snake and told me not to be afraid to lay it on if I had to. I had forgotten all about my spurs, but Fred saw them, and he laughed. He said that baling wire was the only thing that had held the state of Colorado together, but he'd bet I was the first one who ever made spurs out of it. Before he left, he showed me how to swing the black snake so as to make the cracker pop right behind a cow, and said to let Ned have the handle across his rump if he wouldn't go. Then he told me to try to keep the cows bunched pretty well in the middle of the quarter section, and that he'd have one of his men come to help me take them home at night. It was a terrible day. The quarter section wasn't flat like our place, but all roly hills. And those cows knew more tricks than High's blue roan. As soon as Fred was out of sight, they started spreading out in all directions. I beat the tar out of Ned, trying to make him go fast enough so that I could keep them rounded up. But the most I could get out of him was that clumping trot. While I was driving back a few stragglers on one side, others would head for Carl Henry's oat field on the run. When I came back with the first bunch that had tried it, I found that I only had 19 cows left in the herd. The rest had gotten way over one of the hills. I beat on Ned's rump and went to hunt them. His trot was pounding the dickens out of my behind, and it was getting awful tender. I had worn off a piece of skin the size of a silver dollar. Ned had started to sweat a little right where I was trying to sit, and the salt and the sweat made it sting like the blazes. When I got over the hill, I saw my strays a quarter mile away, headed for the oat field. They were in it before I could catch up to them. Father must have been watching me from where he was sowing his alfalfa. I had left Ned and was wading around in the oats trying to drive the cows out with the black snake. I couldn't handle it very well when I was on the horseback, but it was almost useless in the oat field. I didn't have strength enough to keep it in the air through the backswing, and the cracker got tangled in the oats. I guess my yells were getting sort of warbly, and I was about ready to cry when Father showed up on Fanny. He got them out of there in no time, helped me to collect the rest of the herd, and bunched them way over at the east end of the quarter. Four more times he had to come to my rescue before 6 o'clock, and then he helped me get them back to Corcoran's. After we had the cows in the corral, Mrs. Corcoran came out from the house and tried to give Father my quarter. He nodded his head over toward me and said, "Give it to the boy. He certainly earned it." I don't think Mrs. Corcoran liked what Father said, because her face got a little red. She passed the quarter up to me and said,
"Now, don't go and lose it the first thing you do."
Then she said to Father,
"Too much money ain't good for children. These young'uns nowadays haven't no idea of the worth of a dollar. I don't know what things are coming to."
Father only said,
"Better slide off him, son. Mother'll be waiting supper for us."
I slid off and put Ned into the corral with the cows. All the time it took me to climb on the gate to get his bridle off, Mrs. Corcoran kept talking. First she said,
"Little boy, you didn't let my cows get into nobody's crops, did you?"
I kept looking right at the cheek strap buckle, but I knew I had to tell her, so I said,
"Well, sometimes I couldn't make Ned run fast enough to..."
And that's as far as I got. She sounded mad as could be.
"My land sakes alive! You ain't been running my middle cows all over creation, have you?"
I tried to tell her I hadn't, but she didn't even stop to breathe.
"Good gracious!
she said.
I'll wager. I don't get more than half a milking tonight. How a body's going to eke out a living from half milkings, I just don't know. Well, I suppose some allowance has to be made on account of him being city-raised. City-raised younguns ain't been learned to do things when they was young. They don't have the gumption of them that's raised in the country.
Father reached his hand down and pulled me up behind him on Fanny. As he swung me up, he said, "We better be getting along, son." I knew I was fired and got an ache in my throat. It had been a tough job, and I had not done very well, but I had been counting all day on the time Father would let me ride Fanny. I was sure I could manage all right with her, and now that I was fired from my first cowboy job, I was afraid Father would never let me ride her. We were pretty near out to the road when Mrs. Corcoran yelled after us,
"You be sure you ain't late in the morning. Right sharp on 7 o'clock."
And raspy and high as her voice sounded, it still sounded good to me. Fanny could canter right along with Father and me on her. Sitting way back where I was, I could not get a knee hold, so I had to put my fingers under Father's belt. I held as easy as I could so he wouldn't notice and think I was afraid of falling off. We were about halfway home when he said,
"It's a pretty big job for a city-raised fellow. Want to take another crack at it, or have you had enough of cows?"